Thanks for listening to the Gospel Church Podcast. We hope that this podcast is used by God to help us all grow closer to Jesus Christ. If you would like to get connected to our church or give to the mission, you can visit our website at thegospelchurch.com. Now for this week's sermon.
Well, this is a huge chunk of text. We're getting to the end of chapter 16, and then chapter 17 is the prayer of Jesus. And so a lot of what Drake just read us is repetitive with things that we've already gone through in John chapters 13 through 17. When I read this passage this week, as I got to work on it, I thought of a song by U2, which I consider the greatest band in the world, entitled Until the End of the World. And maybe you know the song. The song seems inspired by the events of this night. It seems located in this text that we've been in John. Bono often writes songs with biblical allusions. And it seems to be from the perspective of Judas, the song, Until the End of the World. Judas, who in the song wonders why Jesus is talking about the end of the world. Here's the lyric. Last time we met was a low-lit room. We were as close together as a bride and groom. We ate the food, we drank the wine, everybody having a good time, except you. You were talking about the end of the world. From Judas' perspective in the song, Jesus is all wrong to go where he went, to talk about leaving and not being there with them anymore, and Messiah dying. This is a mystery to all of them. Now, Judas hasn't been in the room for a bit, and it wasn't the actual end of the world that Jesus was talking about here, and I'll come back to the song later. There's another line in the song that I really like that I've actually tried to live by. But the world had a lot left in it when Jesus said these things. He was signaling an end to the disciples' world as they'd known it for the last 3 years of their life as leading up to this night in John 16. Something was going to change. Something was going to be very different. And, you know, talk of his dying, that's what figures of speech and leaving, that's what he's talking about. A crucified Messiah might as well have been the end of the world for these disciples. They are confused by his talk of leaving them and then seeing them again. That's how the passage begins, verses 16 through 18. And he says, he's using figures of speech, he's analogizing his death and his burial and his resurrection that was immediately ahead. I'm leaving, he's been telling them. And in this context, that equates to his dying and his burial. But I'll see you again, he says. Not just here, he said at other places we've seen previously. And there were post-resurrection appearances. And also, when you look at things from God's timing, There is this sense where the period after Jesus' resurrection is something of a countdown clock. Where we are in history is the resurrection is essentially the beginning of the end of history, and Jesus will bring all things to the appointed conclusion that he's bringing them at the point of his return. It's the next great event in hopefully our lifetimes. But when Jesus says, verse 20, let's pick it up there. Looking at verse 20, he says, your sorrow will turn into joy. He has the immediacy of what's coming in view. He's going to die the very next day. And so looking at verse 20 here, he says, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrowfulness will turn into to joy. You will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. What's he saying? He's basically saying the world's rebellion, which we've talked about in other texts, the world's rebellion cannot express itself any worse than to celebrate his death as a death, as the end of him. See, by contrast, when the church celebrates the cross of Christ, which may seem like an odd thing to celebrate, but from the biblical vantage point, we're celebrating the cross from faith in his resurrection. His dying wasn't capital D death. We know we get life because of what he accomplished on the cross. That's why we're cross-centered. But he says, verse 20, the world will rejoice, and you will be sorrowful. You will weep and lament, but then your sorrow will turn into joy. And he compares it, his analogy, his figure of speech, which everybody got, was in verse 21. He talks about a woman giving birth. And she has sorrow, verse 21, because her hour has come. But when she has delivered the baby, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. The baby is the pain. The baby is the joy. A picture, a video, is going to be worth a 10,000 words on this. Take a look at this. This is my daughter Helen and her little boy John Cole. The baby is the pain, right? My daughter, Helen, in that video went 30-plus hours in labor to have that little bundle of joy. But she isn't thinking of that in that beautiful moment. The baby is also the joy. Morgan, this is ahead, all right? So you got to look at the pregnant lady in the congregation and just, you know, and say, this is coming. Now, wait till he's maybe 14, and then she'll think about the labor more often, okay? But what does it say? When a woman's giving birth, she has sorrow because her hour has come, but when she's delivered the baby, so she no longer remembers the anguish for joy human beings have been born in the world. So you also, verse 22, you have sorrow now, but I will see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one, I love this, no one will take that joy from you. Why not? Because when they see Jesus again, they will know. And they will know in a way that they never doubt again. They will know that death could not and did not defeat him, seeing him raised from the dead, and nobody will be able to take that from them. Wouldn't want to repeat the circumstances that lead them to that place, but will take nothing for the resulting lasting joy in his power and grace. And that joy of theirs, seeing Jesus alive and well after his death, they know he dies. And they see him again, and that joy in seeing him again, you know what that translates into in their lives? It translates into gospel confidence and resiliency. These guys would themselves go to their deaths for Jesus. You won't do that knowingly for a lie. But at this point, now we know all that's coming for them, but at this point in the narrative, if we just stick with the text, at this point, it's not their confidence that's in view here. At this point in the text that we're in, it's their confusion. Basically, where our passage began, looking at verses 16 through 18, we get, look, we don't know what you're talking about. All this talk about leaving, and there's still this talk of dying in there. We've heard you say stuff about dying. Messiah doesn't die. That's what they think, and we ourselves would have thought the same thing. And then at the end of the passage, after he's done a little bit more explanation, they say, verses 29 and 30, ah, now you're speaking plainly and not using figurative speech. He keeps using figurative speech. They say, verse 30, we know now, you know all things. You don't need anyone to question you. This is why we believe you came from God. You know what that's like? It's like when you explain a math problem to your teenager. And you say to the teenager, they're struggling in math, and you go, you get this, right? And they go, oh, yeah, I got it. And the report comes a couple weeks later, and they don't got it. Jesus says to these guys in the next breath, after they say, we got it, he goes, you don't got it. Verse 32, the hour is coming. Indeed, it has come when you will be scattered, each to his own home, and leave me alone. Yet I'm not alone. My Father is with me. So with this in mind, let's draw into two things, two takeaways that I think we can get from this back and forth that Jesus and his disciples had here in John 16. One angle I'd like to show you has to do with how Jesus creates tension. He creates tension for his disciples, his friends. We'll look at that. And the other angle has to do with how Jesus meets us in the tension that he creates. It's both and. It's not either or. It's not Jesus either creates tension or relieves it. It's Jesus creates tension, and then he meets us in the tensions that he creates. It's a very different way of God with us. So let's talk about this. This creating tension and meeting us in it, it's all through their back and forth in this large chunk of text we're taking this morning. We really see it best in the final two verses. Verse 32, he creates tension. Verse 33, he meets us in it. We'll get to those verses momentarily. Well, let's just take his creating tension first. Let's talk first about how Jesus creates tension. Verse 32 is very representative. Verse 32, the hour is coming, indeed it has come, when you will be scattered, each to his own home, and will leave me alone. Yet I am not alone, for the Father is with me. Here is Jesus creating tension. They just made a confession of faith in the last breath, verses 29 and 30. But Jesus essentially swats it back at them. Because just moments before, in verses 16 through 18, as we noted, they demonstrated such confusion about his end. Confusion mixed in with rejection of it. And this after his 3-year intensive investment in these men. Look at where this is coming. He's just spent 3 years with them. They've been with him day in and day out. They know what he sounds like. They know what he smells like. And they're having this confusion. Don't be idealistic about discipleship. And look at these guys in this moment, after 3 years in person with Jesus. Not only look here, go to the end of 2 Timothy, Paul's last letter, where Paul says, everybody has abandoned me except for Luke. Why do we go at discipleship so idealistically? Listen, discipleship is one of the hardest things you will ever do, to invest in someone spiritually. We saw earlier in the narrative, some Sundays ago, let me remind you of chapter 14, verses 8 and 9, where Philip says to Jesus, Lord, show us the Father. That's enough for us. And Jesus says to him, chapter 14, verse 9, have I been with you so long, Philip, and you still don't know me? Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Remember that? And even here, verse 31, Jesus answered them. They make this confession, verses 29 and 30. Oh, okay, now we get it. And Jesus goes, really, you now believe? I mean, the sense of that is, that did it? Glad you're with me, finally. It's been, what, 3 years, guys? Now you're believing? There's the tone of that. And then he drops verse 32 on them. Your first act on your own after 3 years of believing and following me is going to be to scatter. Congratulations. You'll all abandon me, not 24 hours from now. Jesus creates tension. He's very purposeful in this. He's not playing with us. It's purposeful. He does something with it. We're coming to that when we talk about how he meets us in tension. But he creates tension. There's an older commentator on this passage from about 80 years ago. He captured the tension here really well. His name is C.H. Dodd. I've got the quote for you. The damping down, the language is a little antiquated. He was writing in the 1930s. The damping down of an enthusiastic confession of faith might seem surprising if we did not remember that it corresponds to a constant pattern, not only in John, but elsewhere. Here it is. It is part of the character and genius of the church that its foundation members were discredited men. That is, the church owes its existence not to their faith and their courage or virtue, which they did show, to be fair to them, Book of Acts and the Epistles, but the church owes its existence to what Christ did for them. And this they could never forget. And C.H. Dodd is absolutely right about that. The church, the character and the genius of the church is that its foundation members were discredited men. We owe our existence as a church not to their great faith, their great courage, their great virtue, but to what Christ did for them, which they never forgot. They never got over, including his patience with them, his grace with them, and then his powering them. And that's what you work for in discipleship. You work for when the penny drops and the disciple, the friend of Jesus, recognizes, all I really have is Christ. I may have gifts and strengths and abilities, but all I really have is Jesus for me. And that makes all the difference. That's when faithfulness begins. When you come to the end of yourself because you realize Jesus has done everything you needed to have done for you. He's done it for you anyway. And he's still there with you always, no matter if other disciples are or not. But Jesus creates tension. I think, if my experience isn't determinative, I don't believe that at all, but I think one of the things you find as you keep reading Jesus, as you keep looking at his life, looking into his life, I think the older that you get in faith, the more you find Jesus will stretch you. I mean, it's kind of this dynamic. The older I get in faith, the more comfortable I am with Jesus. The more I can lean into him, the more I do rely on him constantly and continually. But I also find he stretches me. Because see, my youthful confession of faith was so much idealism, which doesn't mean it wasn't genuine. It was very genuine. It just means it wasn't tested. That's what idealism means. It means you're not tested. Well, I've been tested since then. I still am being tested in many ways. And I find Jesus more compelling and more comforting to me now. But I also find that following him has not made anything really any easier. I mean, not in the sense of strolling down some easy street with him. We're coming to it in verse 33 where he tells us, you know, hey, the world's going to give you tribulation. And we've already said in other sermons, I mean, we've pointed out how Jesus says the world's going to have an oppositional take on me. The world being created order and rebellion, not earth. The world being created order and rebellion. Jesus says they're going to have an oppositional take. He says, some people are even going to hate me. We talked about that in chapter 15. I mean, someone said, expecting life to treat you well because you're a good person is like expecting an angry bull not to charge you because you're a vegetarian. I love that. I see somebody trying to write that down. Expecting life to treat you well because you're a good person is like expecting an angry bull not to charge you because you're a vegetarian. Doesn't work like that. Jesus creates tension, friends. He does. He will give you reasons to cry out to him. Martin Luther said that. Something you don't like comes into your life, that is a cue, that is a prompt. Cry out to him. Martin Luther said, God always gives us reasons to cry out to him. Jesus is not nice. He's not a greeting card. He will stretch us. He creates tension. But he also meets us in the tension. This is verse 33. This is our second and final takeaway. Verse 33. I have said these things to you that in me you may have peace. In him, peace. That's the connection. In the world, in fallen creation, in a world that's where loves are disordered and sin is the broken line through everything, in the world you will have tribulation. It's just kind of a more glorified word for trouble. It's a word that includes strife and enmity, and all that is all wrapped up in tribulation. It's more than just trouble, more than just bad things. You'll have tribulation. Things you want to work well won't work well, even within the church. But take heart, he says. I have overcome the world. You know, peace isn't the absence of sorrow. That's one of the things we learn in discipleship. Peace is not the absence of sorrow. He says, verse 33, I have said things to you that you may have peace. And he says this, consider where he says this. He says this to guys who were this night drowning in sorrows. But Jesus teaches our sorrows how to swim. That's the line from U2 that I wanted to get us to, that line from Until the End of the World. One of my favorite lines of all times. It's become a through line in my life. The line in the song where it says, I was drowning in my sorrows, but then my sorrows learned how to swim. Jesus meets us in our tensions. He doesn't always resolve them. He doesn't always relieve them. He gives us reasons to cry out to Him in them. Sometimes He resolves our tensions. Sometimes He relieves them, but not always. What He more often does is He teaches us to swim. In them, through them, the tensions that we know. Tensions like the tension between sorrow and joy, for instance. Again, back up in verse 20, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn into joy. There's real tension in that. That's a very established tension between sorrow and joy. I have a lot of fear in sharing this because I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm pretty transparent. I'm pretty open, but you know, sometimes you can be transparent to a fault and people get the wrong impression. I don't want to be thought of as a downer to tell you this. But I can say to you that while I have more joy, in fact, in who Jesus is, I have more joy in that today than I've ever had before. I delight in Him more than I ever have before. At the same time, I can tell you, just as a man, a 53-year-old man, I carry this low-grade sadness around in me, and I don't even understand it, and I don't know how it got there, why it's there, what it's doing, but it's just there. I know it is. Again, I'm a little fearful telling you this because I don't want you to think I'm a downer. I don't want somebody to go out of here going, I came for an encouraging word, not God depressed me this morning, you know. That's why you listen to Caleb, right? Sorry. If you work for Caleb, please take that as just a little jest. I'm not a pessimist. I'm not a cynic, okay? I'm not always looking for the flaw in everything. I love to laugh. I love happiness, okay? I love pound cakes. You know why I love pound cakes? Because in the best pound cakes, there's something called the sad streak. Have you ever eaten these southern pound cakes and you got the sad streak when your fork goes into that? Delicioso, all right? It's one of the best tastes in the world. But it's called the sad streak. I have a lot of blessings in my life, a few trials, but more blessings, and a lot of energy for God and for ministry, and yet this sadness is just there. I have to admit it. It's low grade. It's almost sort of like some spiritual mononucleosis or something, you know. I can't quite shake it. And I know I'm not alone in this. That's why I share it, because I figure there is at least a few of you in the room that can relate. And I remember realizing some years ago when I began to realize this about myself, I realized, you know what, this may always be with me. This may never abate. See, for all the Bible I know, I have two theological degrees. For all the praying I do a lot of praying. Maybe it's because I'm a pastor. I hope I would do all the praying I do if I wasn't a pastor. But I do a lot of praying. For all the spiritual disciplines I utilize, there's just always this attending sadness in my experience. I don't want it. I'm not trying to glorify it here. I have discovered in life that the opposite of joy is not sadness. The opposite of joy is hopelessness, and I am not hopeless. I have great hope. But I have not found that Jesus' faithfulness to me includes removing or resolving every tension, every sorrow. Do I know the peace that verse 33 promises? I think I do. There's times I'm pretty sure I do. I even know contentment, even though I'm a Vanderbilt football season ticket holder, proudly. But neither peace nor contentment means the absence of sorrows. I know how to locate my joy in Jesus Christ, and I know how to fight for it with the resources He's given me. It's taken years to learn. But my sorrows, the sorrows that I've asked Him many times to remove, kind of like Paul with a thorn, please take this from me. I don't want this anymore. He comes back with, I'm teaching them how to swim so you don't drown in them. Whatever sadness I've known directly attached to my own failures or others' failures against me or just my own temperament, I have found repeatedly that I can ride it just because of Jesus. He makes the essential difference. Because of Him, I'll get through. I'll get to another side. See, for these disciples, it wasn't like, okay, the resurrection happens and now, you know, bam, everything clicks. And they're suddenly super courageous and they're willing to go 24/7 every day for the gospel, leap all obstacles in a single bound, and constant joy and satisfaction in the work and the word. No. Paul talks to the Corinthians about despairing of life. He says that. We got so down in Macedonia, we despaired of life. We wanted to die, he was saying. We were praying prayers, Lord, take us now. That's Paul. The resurrection happened, and what the disciples realized, the apostles, is the worst that could happen to them was never going to happen. That's what the resurrection said. The worst thing that could happen to you, to be abandoned by God, left to your sin, that's not going to happen. Jesus leaving them was not abandonment by God. It was what had to happen so that they and we can live forever. I love Drew Holcomb's song, Live Forever, by that same title, Ellie Holcomb's husband. Drew's dad is a good friend of mine. He called me Friday. His name is Hamp Holcomb, just to see how I was doing. We were having a great visit over the phone, and I had cause to think of Drew Holcomb's song, Live Forever. Here's the lyric. Laughter is the only thing that'll keep you sane. This world is crying more and more every day. Don't let evil get you down in this madness spinning round and round. I want you to live forever underneath the sky so blue. Some people say faith is a childish game. Well, play on, children, like it's Christmas Day. Sing me a song. Sing me a melody. You can sing out loud because you're a symphony. I want you to live forever underneath the sky so blue. Take courage when the road is long. Don't ever forget that you're never alone. You know why those lyrics are so powerful? It's because there's the joy. The joy comes from knowing that you belong in a way that results in living forever. Jesus wants us to live forever with Him. One of the prophets, I think it's Zephaniah, says he rejoices over us with singing. He takes songs like Drew's song and like Bono's song, and he infuses those songs with his own presence and his own person. And he says, I'm with you, I'm for you. So all that teaching that Jesus gave his friends, yes, it clicked when they saw him again. And then the Spirit came upon them in the book of Acts, and oh boy, watch out. These guys were something else then. But whatever sorrows they would carry from then on, a living Jesus teaches our sorrows to swim because peace with God is guaranteed. I don't just teach this stuff, I try to live it. Verse 33. I've said these things to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world. There's the stroke that our sorrows have to learn in order to swim when it feels like we're going to sink, or we should sink now, but we won't. Why not? Just because He's overcome the world. So I ask you, what's your greatest fear? We all have them. What's your worst fear? It's probably something along the lines of what the world can do to me or what can happen in this world because the world has fallen and therefore we are subject to failures of all kinds and losses of all kinds and pains of all kinds. But we're subject to failures of markets and failures of governments and relational failures and church failures, all the above, all of it. Jesus overcoming the world means He's the only one who does anything lasting about those particular fears and the sorrows that attach to them. Whether those fears ever happen or not, He's the only one who stabilizes me in a way that even if the tension doesn't resolve, and it often doesn't, I'm still good. Because sorrow is never the last word. It's not the last word then, it's not the last word now. The last word belongs to Jesus, and He's not done. May you receive this benediction. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord lift up His countenance upon you. May the Lord make His face to shine upon you and give you peace.